get it underway by hopping on board the telephone line and welcoming in our friend Gary Tangway, the noted sportscaster, radio host, author, educator, actor, and man about town. Hello, Mr. Tangway.
Which all means you can't find a full-time gig.
Listen, you're speaking my language there. What did my grandmother say about me? And it rings true all these years later. Jack of all trades, master of none.
Master of none, I know. You know what I was just watching? I just finished the first part when you rang. The Steve Martin documentary on Apple. Have you seen it?
Isn't that great?
Were you a big Steve Martin fan when he exploded on the scene? Because it was like 75 to 80, he was enormous.
I was, and I went to see him. I think it must have been at the Cumberland County Civic Center when he was doing his big tour. Oh, yeah, I love Steve Martin.
I love the documentary. I loved, of course, Only Murders in the Building is phenomenal.
Mm.
And, you know, I loved him in films and, you know, Father of the Bride and so forth. And he was even in a David Mamet movie.
Yes, he was. Yep.
What was the name of it?
The
Formula. I think it was called The Formula.
It was really good.
It was excellent. He was a very good dramatic actor. I love watching the documentary because I always enjoy how people got to where they are. You know, because as we all know, you have to really work hard, but there's always in everybody's life there's that one turn. Like a young Gary Tangway meeting a Rich Kimball at Boy State, we laugh at it, but I mean, it's kind of how I got a job, you know, in college. I mean, after I, you know, so like, this guy he said like for 15 years, he was trying his act and like for 10 years, nobody got it.
Right. Stuck with it through all that time. They show the reaction of the audience and these middle-aged people looking at each other like, what the hell is going on?
What is he talking about? And some of his stuff, I thought he was funny, but I didn't dislike him, but I always, like, I love Only Murders in the Building. I guess I loved him more as an actor, but I remember friends of mine playing the album and just the whole SNL thing and the Wild and Crazy Guys, and I thought he was okay, but boy, did he struggle at the beginning, and that's the part nobody ever sees, right?
Right,
you know,
right.
The overnight sensation.
By the way, the movie, the Mamet movie, was The Spanish Prisoner.
The Spanish Prisoner, and it was about a formula,
yes.
I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Spanish Prisoner, that, and he was great in it.
But it's so interesting, and you've only seen the first part?
Right, I still have to get to part two, but after I talk to you, I have to go to the grocery store.
Yeah, part two is great, too, because you know, he essentially talks about and admits that he was kind of, could be a little bit distant, aloof, maybe even kind of a jerk to some people early on in his career, but you learn why as you learn about the relationship with his father, which they touch on in that part one, when you know his father says to him, well, after he makes the jerk, his father says, well, you're no chaplain.
Yeah, and he also had a killer show. I just saw at the end of part one, and one of his co-writer said that he did the perfect show. It was an hour and 15 minutes, a perfect show. And his father came in, he says, you know what was wrong with that show?
Yeah.
And that's just, you just can't win sometimes. And of course that has a great impact on you. And he, like he says, I didn't want to have a family because his home life wasn't great.
Right, right. And there's a great line, I think, in the second half, when they're talking about his, you know, there's a darkness to him. There's a distance there, and I think it's Tina Fey who says, and you know, she's coming across as very serious, and says there's just a, you know, there's a longing, there's an emptiness there in Steve Martin that clearly only Martin Short can fill.
Right. Well, kind of. She's probably right, and you know, and she's maybe she's. But I've never known. I mean, those guys are inseparable. I don't even know anything about his family.
You learn a lot more about his family in the second half and how...
second part.
Yeah, you know, he found love and fatherhood, and he's trying his best to be a great dad. There are some wonderful videos that he shot on his phone for his daughter when he's out on the road. It's great.
Have you ever tried to do stand-up comedy?
No, because of all the things... I mean, I've done improv, I've acted, but the thought of being alone on that stage, I can't think of anything more terrifying.
The improv scares the hell out of me.
But at least in improv, I got other people who've got my back. If I have nothing, they'll save me.
Well, yeah, you're pretty quick. You know, you're quick on your feet. But the thing about stand-up, I tried it. I just said, I want to try it. And this is, oh, my God, this is 100 years ago. It was in my 20s after I left Bangor, and I was down here, you know, doing radio and banging around. And I wrote, like, a 10-minute thing. And there were all kinds of open mics, right? So I did want to catch a rising star.
Whoa.
And it was open mics. It was like, well, it wasn't that big. It wasn't that big of a deal. I mean, basically, it was like Sunday night at 1 in the morning. You know what I mean? That's when you could go on. I mean, it's not that big. It wasn't like, you're not doing Friday night at 9 before Lenny Clark. You know what I mean?
Right, right. And the crowd is really receptive at 1 a.m. too.
Yeah, well, whoever was there. But, you know, it was you would sign up ahead of time, and there'd be 100 people there, and you do 10 minutes, and you bowl. And the first time I did it, I did 10 minutes, and I got some laughs, which in my mind I was like, oh, God, I killed Rich. And, you know, you can look, just tell a couple of stories about your friend. And the second time I did it, I did okay. And then I was talking to a lot of other guys, and I watched, you know, there were people with just notebooks of material, and people that were like all in. And then I did a third one at a poetry night at the Concord Inn in Concord, Mass. Every time, I live one town over now, but every time I drive by it, I have this flashback that haunts me. And, you know, when it was like Hoot Night, when everybody's in there playing Michael Row Your Boat Ashore, you know, on the guitar, it probably stand-up comedy wasn't like the best thing to do. And I totally bombed for like 10 minutes. I bombed.
Ugh.
And then I just recognized, I went, and then you got to, stand-up comedy is the hardest thing in the world.
Yes.
And you have to, and it's not even that, it's not even like your friends that are funny. Like, you know, I have friends that, you know, you have friends, we have friends that are all funny. That's just scratching the surface. You know, I would like listen, I read Norm MacDonald's book. Or you hear about Mark Barron. I mean, they 3 months to develop a joke.
Well, and the other thing is this. You know, because you've done it all your professional life here. Yeah, I've done it. I can work a room. If I'm, you know, emceeing an event, hosting something, I can work the room. I think I can read the audience pretty well. And certainly you do that in improv. But that's not the same as being able to hit story after story, beat after beat, laugh after laugh. Because, boy, when that silence comes back, it's deafening.
Oh, it's tough. Like, I'll still see, like, I went and saw Steve Sweeney. You know, he was up he was up on Route 1, not at the Kowloon. He was doing a benefit. And, I mean, Steve's a legendary Boston comic, and he just killed. I mean, he went on for an hour, and he's like 70, and just joke after joke and just destroyed. And that's, like, years and years of work. I mean, it's just, like the Martin thing, you know, where he says it took me 15 years to develop my act. And then he exploded. And he talked about how he did the Playboy Club in San Francisco, where everybody was in their 40s or 50s. He goes, nobody laughed.
No, they didn't get it.
Next night he's in Los Angeles and everybody's like 20 and he's a rock star.
Yeah.
You know, it's just fascinating. It's stand-up comedy is, without question, it is the hardest thing to do in show business. There's just no doubt about it.
I should probably do it at some point, but I've come close enough to it and watched others try it and fail that I thought, I don't think I could do that.
Now, especially now on Netflix, there are so many great ones. And what happened with the actor strike, Netflix needed content. So, you know, all of these comedians, even people I'd never heard of, and excuse me, sorry, I got a cough there. And I'm like, who's this person? And they go on for an hour and 15, and I'm like crying.
Yeah.
I'm like, you know, I'm like in tears, like, oh my God. And they do it night after night after night. Yeah, it's a special skill.
If anybody hasn't
seen the Steve Martin thing, you should watch it.
It's great. It's great. You know what else I've noted here doing the show all these years with comedians is the really talented guys are the guys you can have on the show who drop the shtick, but can still be funny. You can have a conversation, you can talk about their life, and they're just naturally funny people. But there are those, you've been a handful of guys we've had on that just, and maybe it's because that's their experience doing radio, they want to come on and do their act. And I try to tell them ahead of time, you know, that's not what we do. I want to talk to you as a person, and if you can still be funny in that context, great.
Agreed. Now, I did have an experience that kind of went south. Remember Dane Cook?
Oh, God, I can't stand that guy. Yeah.
Well, he's a Boston kid, Boston guy. And he, again, it was like he had a huge following, and it was a college thing.
Right, right.
It was more visual. And I was filling in on RKO in the morning because EEI and RKO were in the same building at one point. And I filled in on the RKO morning show with another guy, and they said, well, this young comedian's coming in, Dane Cook. He wasn't Big Ten or anything, but he was more physical. And even it bombed. We were, like, there for 15 minutes, and that, like, we couldn't even get a conversation going with the poor guy. And then, like, 2 years later, he exploded, and I said to the guy who's doing the show, is that the same guy? You know? It's kind of like, you know, two different things. Whereas I heard Rob Schneider, he was on with Tetcher and Rich once, and it was a conversation. He was great.
You know, we had Gilbert Gottfried on. Nah, about
oh
a year.
God, what a G.
About a year before he died, and he was good. And for about the first 7 or 8 minutes, he was doing Gilbert Gottfried. And then
right.
I started talking about the documentary and his family and got into some pretty personal stuff, and it was amazing. His voice changed, and it became the real Gilbert. And he was great. He opened up, and yet he was still laugh out loud funny. But to me, it was better because it was funny being the real person, not the character you see on stage.
Rich, I can't remember if I have talked to you since I was fortunate enough to be in that movie with Jamie Lee Curtis.
Oh yeah, yeah. We talked a little bit, but you couldn't tell us too much about it last time.
Well, I wanted to bring up Albert Brooks.
Oh my God!
He was there too.
Genius.
And when you say, like, laugh, just funny. The first time I heard Albert Brooks, because you are a little bit older than me, I was working in. I didn't really, like. I know he was big on the Tonight Show in the 70s, but I never really saw it. But then when I was working in New Hampshire and I had to go in to do the mornings, I would listen to the repeat of Larry King at like 5 o'clock, and he would go on Larry King. And the first time I heard him, I mean, I thought Larry was going to have a heart attack. I mean, he was on the floor, and Brooks was just like on a roll, just like, and you know, I think we did talk about it, like, you know, the story with Carl Reiner the first time when he was 12. He said it was kind of that new wave comedy like Steve Martin, where it was almost making fun of comedy. It was like, I'm going to be funny, but I'm not going to be funny. But that the fact that I'm not going to be funny is funny, right? You know, where he did a magic trick at his buddy Rob Reiner's house. That didn't work, and that was the bit.
Right,
and that was the bit, and Carl Reiner was on the floor like wetting his pants, and Brooks just had King, he destroyed him. When we were on the set, he's the same way. His timing, it's and I'm sorry if I'm repeating myself, but I just thought his timing is just natural. And his father was a comedian, not Mel Brooks. Everybody thinks it's not Mel Brooks. He was another.
Park your carcass. It was his name was Park your carcass.
Right. And he did you see the Brooks documentary?
I did. Yes, with that Reiner did. Yeah.
Yes. Oh my God, it's fantastic. So then he goes. He was just like getting the. You know, you get in the van and you go to the set. And he's like, if I said it, it would be a comment. He says it, and everybody laughs. And I know people listening may say, well, people think they need to laugh with Albert Brooks. I go, no. There's just something in the way he did it. He's just funny. And that's, you know, there are just some people who are just, and on the set, he's cracking little jokes and joking around with everybody. That dude just rolls out of bed funny. And then he puts it to work. And I mean, even Norm MacDonald, I met with Norm MacDonald for like an hour. And he's just, his mannerisms, he's just funny, you know? And then they put in the work for an hour. To do an hour 15 of material, I mean, forget about it. So comedians are fascinating. They're they're an interesting breed, man.
Oh, absolutely.
They are the weirdest of the weird, but boy, are they talented. The great ones are so talented.
Gary Tagway with us here on Downtown. So, yeah, you did this movie with Brooks and Jamie Lee Curtis, James L. Brooks directing. How did you get to talk at all with Jamie Lee Curtis? Were you in any scenes with her?
Oh, yeah, actually, I did. And I have, we talked. God, my memory sucks. The Bear. She was in season 2, episode 6 of The Bear.
Yeah, oh, so good. That Christmas episode is just one of the great TV episodes of all time.
Okay, this I can talk about. So I'm sitting on the set, because it's nothing about the plot. And I'm sitting on the set. And, you know, Rich, one of the great things about our job is that you meet enough people that are in the public eye that it doesn't bother you. Like, you don't care. Like, you run into enough athletes. You've certainly had a run-in with a lot of musicians and stars and so forth, and it just doesn't it's not a big deal.
No, and you talk to them, just like they're people, because, well, they are.
Well, they are, and I go, so, Jamie, because she was, like, at the bar, and she introduces herself to everybody, and there was, you know, she's hanging out, and I just go, Jamie, I go, look, can I ask you, episode 6, season 2 of The Bear, start at the beginning. Right? And if people haven't watched it, it is an episode that you can watch on its own.
Yes.
Actually. You can watch on its own. And you don't have to watch. I guess it would help to watch the rest of the season. She literally put her hand on my hand. She leaned in, and she gave me a half hour on the whole thing.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And for acting geeks like you and me, I mean, she told me about the whole process, about how it all went down. They shot it over 3 days. She gave a lot of credit to the camera work, because it was all handheld, you know, because of the motion and so forth. She broke it all down, and then she started to talk about everything, anything, everywhere, all at once, which she won the Academy Award for.
Yeah.
And I go, and of course me and I go, yeah, I go, Jimmy, I got to be honest with you. I go, I didn't understand the damn movie till the last line. I was in it, and I didn't. She goes, I was in it. I didn't get it till I saw it.
That's great.
And she was like, and she said, All of those visual effects, that was a small budget film, and they shot it in 31 days.
Wow!
And four producers, or the director and the producer, whatever, figured out how to do the camera work with YouTube tutorials.
Oh my God!
They just said they didn't have money for like big CGI and all that stuff. And they said, all right, we got to figure out how we want to do this. And they did it. And she goes, yeah, it was crazy. She goes, we were doing stuff. She's awesome. She's like, she works. She'll do it. She's the best. Just the best. I mean, you know, just very approachable. What hasn't she done?
I mean, well, I was talking a couple of weeks ago with the wonderful director, Ed Zwick. And he's very good.
I got to listen to that.
And he's great friends with Jamie Lee. And he said she's a perfect example of somebody who grew up in the business, but is at the top of her game now, because she has reinvented herself so many times through the years. And every new appearance, you're like, oh, I didn't realize Jamie Lee Curtis could do that.
She's just really talented. You know, she's really talented. And she works. You know? I mean, You just show up. I mean, even like when Chappaquiddick, I mean, you know, Jason Clark, who was in, you know, Pet Sematary, you talk to him. That dude, again, I know it's not, movie making is, it's still a great living. Don't get me wrong. But, and I don't want to make it out like it's manual labor. But, you know, that dude was in every scene of that movie, and it's 12 hours, and you're lying. You're just going. And there's none of this, like, you're a star baloney.
Right.
It's like, we got to get this right. And, you know, to see, like, James L. Brooks and Albert Brooks and Jamie Lee Curtis sitting there talking about a scene. I mean, the way you would with two people in a play. And, you know, Jim Brooks says, you know, oh, I want to do that. Albert goes, okay, well, how about if I came in? Can we do it this way? And then, you know, they all, it's the same. But they're just very, they work. You know, like that. Yeah, they're movie stars, but they're actors first, and they work. And she works. She doesn't, like, a lot of people with what she had done for that movie that she won an Academy Award for, they would have turned it down, you know, but
right.
She didn't.
Well, same thing with The Bear, because, hey, people people often want to be in a situation where they're flattering and they look good. And man, she is willing to go in the complete opposite direction.
Well, plus she's done that, you know, yeah. with, you know, whether it was in Trading Places or with Arnold. What was the movie with Arnold?
No.
She's hanging from the helicopter.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
True Lies.
I mean, you know, so, yeah, so everybody, True Lies. So, you know, people have seen that, and they know that she was obviously very beautiful. Boy, can she perform, can she act.
That's awesome. Is there a target release date for the film?
You know, I think they just wrapped like a week or two ago, you know, so, you know, they'll edit that thing to death probably next year.
Yeah.
You know, and you just hope you I make the cut.
Right. Almost done with your semester of teaching?
Yeah, Emerson wraps up next week. Anna Maria wraps up next week, too. And I'll tell you, kids are amazing. You know, it's been a great experience. It really has been. It's been a phenomenal experience. And, you know, my attitude with these kids now has changed since, you know, when I graduated from college or my dad always said, you know, I have a backup plan. You know, we were doing the radio thing and they never really, they always supported it, but I don't know if they ever thought, I don't know if they'd ever think like their kid's going to do, Celtics broadcast, you know, or make a living at it because it's hard to do. And I was just, I loved it. So I'm just going to keep doing it. And I didn't make any money at first, as you know. But he was always like, have a plan B. And I tell my kids, no plan B. And I know that may people disagree with it, but I said, it is so hard to do what you really want to do. You got to make a living, But I mean, if there's something you really want to do, no plan B. Like if you need to work at a store while you're doing what you want to do, you know, fine to pay your rent and you do whatever. But you can't think like I have a backup plan. You have to think like I'm going to do this and this is it, because I think it takes so much energy to accomplish it now.
I agree. And if you have a plan B, it's too easy to walk away.
It's too easy to walk away. I mean, you know, like with you, like us in radio, I mean, I never really wanted to do anything else. I mean, like you taught and stuff, but you still do the radio, you know, and you're still connected to it. And you still love it, but like, you know, I just never really wanted, whether it be acting or performing or radio, or whatever, never wanted to do anything else, you know? So there you go.
I'm at the gym the other day. Who's on the treadmill next to me? George Hale.
How is the whale? How is that old bastard?
He's doing great. Just got back from Florida. And, yeah, he's down there. I see him on a regular basis at the gym working out.
Oh, my God. How old is he?
I think he's 92, if not 93 now.
Amazing. It's amazing.
Still on the air every morning.
God love him. I mean, he's just unbelievable.
He said something about, he said, you know, maybe the next eclipse, I'm going up. And he pointed up, and I said, George, you pointed up. You sure you're going in that direction? He goes, kid, I fooled him this long.
Yeah, I know. He's got a million of them. It's unbelievable. He's going to hit 100. You watch, man.
I hope so.
They should make currency. He should be on a something.
Question about that. Hey, a couple quick sports questions here. Tonight's the NFL draft. Do you, I think I know the answer. Do you miss even for a moment being on the air, having to participate in the weeks of speculation about the NFL draft?
No. but people love it, though.
I know.
I do enjoy listening to Felgram as when they do their big board. Which I don't know if people can watch it, you know, up there on, because Felger thinks it's a joke too.
Right,
he goes,
right.
He used to go, my God. He goes, you're not going to know for 3 years.
Right.
He goes, you're not going to know. And then we had this great quarterback class with Mac and everybody. They're all gone. They've all been traded. Mm-hmm. All done. And I said, one thing I said in my class today, I said, everybody needs a quarterback, but the problem is there aren't enough of them.
Yeah.
It's become a quarterback league, but there aren't enough of them. that can do it. So in the past, you could have like a, you know, a running offense where you could have a Phil Sims, right? Or you could have a defensive-minded team, and you could have a game manager like a Trent Dilfer win a Super Bowl. Now you need like a quarterback that is smart, can run, can throw far, can read defenses, can do all those things. How many guys are like, there's like four of them.
Yeah.
If that. So it's, you know, everybody's looking for them. There just aren't enough quarterbacks to fulfill the need. That's just, you know, the way it is. But I enjoy it. Like, so what Felger and Maz do is they take these draft magazines, they put up on a wall, and they throw a dart at it.
Which and is the appropriate track. Response, yeah.
And the one thing, they threw a dart, and they hit Jimmy Garoppolo the year the Patriots took him. And that's their, and what they do is then they talk about the player and they give out the information of the player. But I mean, that's what it is. But the thing that amazes me about the whole draft is, you know, who cares what I think? Fans love it and they don't care about the results. It's like, there's no answer, right? Nobody really sticks around for the answer.
No,
it's all the pre-show.
It's just
the speculation.
And it's getting your football fix in the off season.
Yeah, which is why it's amazing. NFL has done a great job with it. It's amazing.
All right, Celtics, amazing. did you watch last night? Every time
that was awful.
Every time I think they've learned something, they do that. They lay an egg.
Yeah, I mean Al Pacino from The Worst Godfather. You know, every time I try to get out, they let me back. They pull me back in. I know that you got to squash these guys. They should have swept them.
Yeah,
they should have swept the Heat. There's no doubt about it. You know, I still think it's Denver to win anyways, and they're just. That's just who the Celtics are.
And also that, you know, and I would not have guessed this 15 years ago, but, man, Eric Spoelstra is a hell of a coach.
He is, you know, and Pat Riley knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
Pat Riley knew what he was doing when he put him in charge. And Spoelstra with Jimmy Butler, I mean, he's not, I mean, God, they, you know, they made it to the finals. So Jimmy, if you make it to the finals with Jimmy Butler, who's not a great player, he's a very good player. And, I mean, Spoelstra's done that. Yes, he's a very good coach. Very good coach. And maybe our guy isn't ready.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's the thing that I wonder about Joe. It's his second year. He's definitely a player's coach. You know, when somebody's tail needs to be chewed, is he the guy that's going to do it? I don't know.
Yeah. It doesn't happen in 2 years. It takes a while.
It takes a while. So, I mean, I still think they'll make the finals because the East is depleted.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are beat up. I don't think if the Knicks were 100%, I think they give them a run for the money, but they're not. And so I think the Celtics will get there. But, boy, that guy in Denver, man, he just does whatever he wants at his own pace.
Absolutely. Gary Tanguay. Gary, great talking with you as always, my friend. Be well, and we'll catch you again in a few weeks.
All right, Richie. I'll talk to you later.
All right. Thanks, Gary. It is 5:30 here on Downtown on this Thursday afternoon.